Good morning. Welcome, excuse me, to Peninsula Bible Church. We're continuing our look this morning in the book of Jeremiah. But before we do that, I have a trivia challenge for us, okay? A little contest. And this is kind of a Pete's versus Starbucks thing. I'm a big fan of coffee. So we're going to have a little bit of a challenge here and see who knows their trivia, their Pete's and Starbucks trivia. So, first question. And raise your hand if you know the answer. I'll be trying to look out for the first person to raise their hand. Who can tell me where the first Pete's coffee shop was opened? Over here, I saw a hand.
Berkeley,
you are right. For your right answer, you win a $20 gift certificate to Pete's Coffee. Enjoy. Okay, now for the Starbucks fans here. Who knows where King Tut is buried? Yes. Just kidding. Who knows where the first Starbucks was opened? Back here, Jin. Pike's Place Market in Seattle is correct. For your knowledge, you win a $1 off coupon for Starbucks that can only be used at a Target. And it expired sometime in 2007, so congratulations.
I'll trade you.
Good job, Jin. Are there any complaints about my trivia challenge? Does it seem unfair to any of you by any means? Well, maybe it is, but today we're talking about fairness. And we're talking about when things seem unfair. And we're asking the question of what happens when God seems unfair. See, if you remember, last week we talked about why God is hard to believe in and what are some of the things that make faith in Him, make coming to Him as a personal God challenging. One of those things is that we tend to question God's character. We tend to wonder if He really is good. And one of the most common ways people do that is they think He's unfair. They think that it's unfair that God would uniquely express Himself in Jesus Christ. People think it's unfair that God would have certain sexual standards that He expects His creation to live by. They think it's unfair that God would treat people differently throughout the world. And sometimes it's a personal thing. People say it's unfair that I'm going through this. Whatever I'm experiencing in my life, it's not fair that I should have to go through this. And I think if you're honest, we've probably felt, all of us at times, that life isn't fair, that God isn't fair. We've looked around the world and thought, why do these things happen? It doesn't seem right. Or we've looked at our own lives and we've felt that way. So today we're asking the question, who does God think He is? How can God do the things He does? And is it really fair? This is a question that people in our world are asking. And if you remember from Jeremiah, he was given the task of preaching a message of destruction to God's people, telling them that Jerusalem was about to be wiped out. And their feeling was, well, that doesn't seem very fair. And so partly this passage that we're looking at today is given to these people as a way of explaining why God does what He does, as a way of helping God's people to understand Him so that they can know what His character really is. We're looking at Jeremiah 18, 1 to 17 this morning. We're asking this question, who does God think He is? That's on page 768 in the Bibles in your pews, if you want to follow along. And what's neat about this passage is that it's organized very similarly to the way that we tend to organize sermons. I think Jeremiah probably got that from us. But he gives you first an illustration. He gives us kind of a picture, something that we understand. And then he goes from that picture to give us a principle, some idea, something about the way God is that illustration illustrates for us. And then finally he applies that. He talks directly to the people of Israel in that time, in that place, and he applies this principle to their lives so they can understand who God is. So as we walk through this, we're going to be kind of unpacking each of those things. First there's an illustration, then a principle, and finally the application. So let's start out by looking at this picture. This is in the first four verses, and I'll read those for us. Jeremiah 18, 1 to 4. This is the word that came to Jeremiah from the Lord. Go down to the potter's house, and there I will give you my message. So I went down to the potter's house, and I saw him working at the wheel. But the pot he was shaping from the clay was marred in his hands. So the potter formed it into another pot, shaping it as seemed best to him. So God asks Jeremiah to go on a little field trip and to visit the potter's house and to see what this potter is doing. And it's helpful for us to understand two things about pottery. First of all, pottery was probably the most significant piece of technology that the Israelites had, that their culture had. We don't usually think of pottery as technology, but in a primitive culture it was. It was something that, a tool that solved kind of a problem of life for them. If you try to imagine society prior to the invention of pottery, there was no way to hold water. There was no way to store food. There was no container except for very, very primitive natural ones that you could find. So societies would have to live very close to water sources. They'd have to eat food immediately. And when pottery became invented, it completely revolutionized ancient culture. It meant that people could travel. They could not have to be right near water. Societies could spring up in places where there weren't before. And so this was a piece of technology that was critical for the way of life for ancient Israelites. Their lives centered around pottery. It was a common feature for them. Not only that, the potter's house was a common feature in all of their societies, in all of their villages. See, because you had pottery and you needed pottery to live, and pottery typically breaks, especially if you're living in the desert in a tent or in an ancient village. And so you'd have to go to the potter's house and you'd get new pottery. And this was kind of an everyday thing for them. It was like the grocery store for us. There was a potter's house on every corner. My sister is a missionary in Ecuador, and we visited her in November. And one of the things you notice as you're driving around rural Ecuador is that every little town has a carpenter's shop. In fact, bigger towns have one about every quarter mile. It's kind of a primitive corrugated roof and a bunch of saws and different equipment underneath with wood and sawdust. And in that culture, it's cheaper and easier to go to a carpenter and say, I need a table, or I need a chair, or I need a bed, than it is to go to a store and buy one. So carpenters are everywhere. And that's the way it was for the Israelites. The potter's house was a common feature of their life. So the first thing we see is how God tries to communicate his truth, how he communicates to his people. And we realize that he chooses something that's really central to their experience, something that they know all about, something that they live with every day. And we realize that as God tries to let his people know him more, as God reaches out and wants his people to understand him, he does so in a way that they will understand. He picks an image that is connecting for them. We realize that God stoops down and he speaks our language. God speaks our language when he wants us to understand him. And it's kind of incredible that he would do so, that he would go through the trouble of speaking in a way that we could understand using this powerful image. We took our kids roller skating this past week, which was a lot of fun. It's been a while since I've been roller skating. But at one point, my daughter Eliana and I were skating, and she was kind of chatting, and she said, Daddy, why is there gravity on Earth but not in space? And, you know, the natural question that would come up as you're roller skating, apparently. Now, I barely understand the answer to that question, and so I had to think of a way to explain gravity to my first grade daughter. And I'm not going to tell you how I did, because you probably would tell me I'm wrong, but I did, and she bought it. But that's what God's trying to do here. He's trying to get his people to understand something very complicated about himself, so he comes down to our level, and he uses an image we're familiar with. And this is one of the most beautiful ways of how God communicates to us, but it's also one of the things, honestly, that makes the Bible sometimes tricky to understand. Because these people knew about potter's houses, but we don't. That's not something we're familiar with. And so we need to try and understand from their culture what this means in order to really understand what God was saying. But if that's true of us, then it's also true that the people in our world that aren't familiar with the ways of God start from an even less foundation of knowing anything of God or who he is. And so it can kind of be an encouragement to us that as we want to be people that help the world to understand God, that help the people around us to see God, we need to remember that even God is willing to find out about the people he wants to communicate to speak in their language. And that should be a lesson to us, that we need to know the people we are around if we're going to know what they're familiar with. If we're going to take the ideas that we know about God and help people to understand them, we need to put them in language they can grasp and use images that they're familiar with. That's what God does here, and it can be a model for how we communicate with our world as well. So that's the image. This potter, and he's building a pot, some type of clay. It doesn't go well, so he smashes it and starts over. Well, what's the principle God's trying to get at here? Let's look at verses 5 to 10 to try and see that. Then the word of the Lord came to me. O house of Israel, can I not do with you as this potter does? Declares the Lord. Like clay in the hand of the potter, so are you in my hand, O house of Israel. If at any time I announce that a nation or kingdom is to be uprooted, torn down, and destroyed, and if that nation I warned repents of its evil, then I will relent and not inflict on it the disaster I had planned. And if at another time I announce that a nation or kingdom is to be built up and planted, and if it does evil in my sight and does not obey me, then I will reconsider the good I had intended to do for it. So what God is saying is that this image of the potter with his clay forms a model for how he relates to his people. He says that as the potter treats the clay, so God has the prerogative to treat his creation, his people. He can do with them as he sees fit. And in fact, it's not unfair for him to do so. But at first, that's kind of a harsh comparison. You get this picture of God who does whatever he wants, who has complete control over the clay and just does anything he wants to without concern or relationship with that clay. And this is the way a lot of people in our world understand God. They think of God as kind of a distant, powerful creator who, if he's real, certainly seems to be uncaring or unloving. There's a blog online called Debunking Christianity. I was reading it the other day, and one of the entries in it has the title, God is a Sadistic Monster. And the person in this blog kind of goes on to talk about how cruel God is. And if this God is real, he's certainly not a God that she would want to believe in. And this picture of the potter and the clay is almost part of that image. And if that's all you have, that might be how you perceive of God. But only if you stop reading at verse 6. Because if you go on, you see that God does something very interesting with this image. He goes on and he says, if I'm planning a disaster and I tell my people about that, and then they change, they decide to change their behavior, then I'll respond to them and I'll change what I had planned. He says also, if I'm planning something good, if I'm planning some blessing for my people, but they turn away from me and they disobey me, then I'll respond to that. I'll change my mind. Now, clay doesn't change. Clay doesn't one day decide, you know, I'm not working out very well, this side's lopsided, I'm going to pull it in and do better. And the potter certainly doesn't respond back to the clay and say, oh, I see this pot is actually trying really hard to work with me. Maybe I'll let it keep going. See, the image of the potter and the clay is used here not just to show some similarity between how God creates and relates to his people, but to show that there's some difference there as well. And so in verses 7 through 10, you see how God kind of breaks apart that analogy. And he says that actually, the way I relate to my people is deeper and more full than the way that the potter relates to the clay. This is an example of a biblical argument that's pretty common. It's a lot of people call it the how much more comparison. And it's pretty common in the Bible that an author would take an image and say, this is kind of like what God does, but God does far beyond it. How much more does God love his people? Or how much more does God relate to his people? You find it a lot in Paul's writings in the New Testament, and it's a Hebrew usage as well. So what God is saying is that I don't relate to you just like a potter does to the clay. I could. That would be fair. But I relate to you even deeper. What I do, my relationship with you is responsive. It's dynamic. It's more than fair. There's a song I like called Call and Answer about a romantic relationship between a man and a woman. And the woman is kind of trying to figure out if she really wants to be in this relationship. And the man is trying to woo her and trying to convince her and really serve her. This dynamic of fairness is really played out well. Listen to this verse. This is the woman speaking, or this is the man speaking. You think it's only fair to do what's best for you and you alone. You think it's only fair to do the same to me when you're not home. I think it's time to make this something that is more than only fair. So if you call, I will answer. And if you fall, I'll pick you up. And if you court this disaster, I'll point you home. See, the woman thinks that she wants the relationship to be fair. She wants everything to be equal. And the man says, a relationship isn't about fairness. It's not about making sure that you get treated the same way in every circumstance, that both parties are equal. A relationship is more than fair. It's about sacrifice and love. And it's time to make this relationship something that is more than only fair. That's what God says here. He says the way the potter treats the clay, that's fair. If I were to treat my people that way, that would be fair. But I'm more than that. I'm more than fair to you. And so we hear this message that God is more than fair to us. God is more than fair. And again, it's amazing that our Creator God, the Creator of the universe, the potter who can do whatever he wants with the clay, would choose to respond in a dynamic relationship with his creation out of love and mercy, that he goes above and beyond what's necessary. One of the complicated things about doing that, though, in a relationship, is that it can seem to rewrite the rules. See, we tend to associate fairness with the things that typically happen, with kind of our normal experience. So if tomorrow morning I decided that all week I was going to serve my kids ice cream for breakfast, they would be thrilled. I'd actually enjoy it too. So we have ice cream for breakfast and they're excited about it. And the next day, ice cream for breakfast. And the next day, ice cream for breakfast. But let's say next Monday I decide, that's it. We're going back to cereal. I can 100% guarantee you what the first words out of their mouth will be. It's not fair. We've been having ice cream for breakfast. Why should we have cereal now? And yet, there's nothing really unfair about going back to cereal. It's just that the way we work, we tend to associate whatever is happening to us, whatever good things we experience, we think that that's fair. And if those things change, then we cry foul. And then we say, wait a second, it's not fair. This is what I'm used to getting. So we see this with God too, that he treats us more than fair. He loves us. He's merciful. He's forgiving. He initiates what? He speaks our language. And we start to say, well, yeah, he should. He should speak my language. He should treat me that way. And we start to drift. And if that happens and God says, there comes a time when if I promise good and my people turn away, I'll change my mind on that good promise. And then we say, boy, that's not fair. It's not fair that God should treat me that way. Now, I'm willing to bet that none of you came to church today expecting to get a gift card to Pete's. Am I right? Nobody was like, oh, I got to get up so I can get that gift card. But I'm also willing to bet that the fact that most of you didn't get a gift card and one of you got an expired coupon to Target makes you think, boy, that's not fair. Why didn't I get the gift card? See, we tend to kind of reevaluate what we think is fair. And this happens on a macro level as well. A few years ago, there was a book published called Desire of the Everlasting Hills by Thomas Cahill. Some of you might be familiar with it. The book was about Jesus, and one of the things he suggests is he kind of reinterprets some of the story of Jesus, but he looks at the implications of Jesus' life throughout culture, and he suggests that most of our Western values, some of our central values about freedom and self-sacrifice and that the evilness of self-interest, that those things actually came from Jesus, and they're now kind of embedded in our cultural value system. What's fascinating to me is that one of people's complaints today is that Jesus isn't fair. They say Jesus has his own interest in mind, that God is sadistic. And yet what's amazing is that the whole idea of self-interest being evil came from this God, came from Jesus. See, in ancient times, all the gods were sadistic monsters. If you were a god, wouldn't you be? I mean, you had ultimate power. There's no reason not to be a sadistic monster. So the very charge of God that that should be wrong for a God comes from Jesus himself that says, no, I lay down my life for those I love. I hold other people's interests above mine. And so you see how kind of the picture of fairness gets rewritten, and all of a sudden our culture turns against God and charges him with being unfair because he doesn't fit this model of what we think he should do. So this passage does two things for us. First, it affirms that God is more than fair as he relates to us. But second, it tells us that it's part of our normal experience that we don't see it that way. It tells us that it's common for God's people to see the way God interacts with them and to say that's not fair. And to me, that's encouraging to know that it shouldn't surprise me when I come into a situation and I think, it doesn't seem fair to me that God's doing this to that person or God's doing this to me. The truth is that God's people have always struggled with whether God is fair. And I think we always will. But the truth is, on top of that, that he is fair. In fact, he's more than fair. So we looked at the illustration. You have this kind of visit to the potter's house. And then you have this principle of how God relates to his people. Then finally, we see the application, how God applies this. Listen to verses 11 to 17. Now, therefore, say to the people of Judah and those living in Jerusalem, this is what the Lord says. Look, I am preparing a disaster for you and devising a plan against you. So turn from your evil ways, each one of you, and reform your ways and your actions. But they will reply, it's no use. We will continue with our own plans. Each of us will follow the stubbornness of his evil heart. Therefore, this is what the Lord says. Inquire among the nations. Who has ever heard anything like this? A most horrible thing has been done by virgin Israel. Does the snow of Lebanon ever vanish from its rocky slopes? Do its cool waters from distant sources ever cease to flow? Yet my people have forgotten me. They burn incense to worthless idols, which make them stumble in their ways and in the ancient paths. They made them walk in bypaths and on roads not built up. Their land will be laid waste, an object of lasting scorn. All who pass by will be appalled and will shake their heads. Like a wind from the east, I will scatter them before their enemies. I will show them my back and not my face in the day of their disaster. So God goes back to the principle that he mentioned, and he says, I am planning a disaster against my people. But I've already told you that if you change your ways when I plan disasters, I'll relent. I'll change my plans. So he tells them, this is your opportunity to change, to repent, to come back to me. And they say, nah, we're not interested. Thanks anyway. And God says, look around. Even the nations aren't that dumb. In the face of a warning that you would keep doing it, even though you know it's going to bring about your disaster. Jerry Seinfeld has a comedy routine about the invention of helmets. It's pretty funny. Listen to this quote. I'm not going to be able to do it justice, but I'll try it anyway. He says, there are many things you can point to as proof that the human is not smart. But my personal favorite would have to be that we needed to invent the helmet. What was happening, apparently, was that we were involved in a lot of activities that were cracking our heads. We chose not to avoid doing those activities, but instead to come up with some sort of device to help us enjoy our head-cracking lifestyles. And even that didn't work, because not enough people were wearing their helmets, so we had to come up with the helmet law. Which is even stupider, the idea behind the helmet law being to preserve a brain whose judgment is so poor, it does not even try to avoid the cracking of the head it's in. And this is essentially what God says about Israel. That he's warning them, what you're doing is going to result in disaster. Now's your chance to stop. And they say, no thanks. We'll continue on with our head-cracking lifestyle. Thanks anyway. And it's unbelievable that they would make that choice. He compares them to the snow of Lebanon. And this is kind of an interesting comparison. Because he essentially says, what makes the snow of Lebanon is that it's in Lebanon. It's on these particular mountains. And if that snow were to melt and leave or be snow somewhere else, it would no longer be the snow of Lebanon. See, the defining feature for this snow of Lebanon is that it is in this place. And he says the defining feature of you, my people, Israel, your defining thing is that you are related to me. I make you Israel. And yet he says, my people have forgotten me. They turn away. The thing that makes them who they are, they've given up. Now, what's true about them is that they thought what made them Israel was living in this land. And so they thought that when God said, I'm going to send you out of this land, I'm going to send you into exile, they thought God was destroying Israel. They thought that their identity was being destroyed by God. And what God is saying is, no, you've already destroyed your identity. Your identity comes from your relationship with me, not from the land you live on. So what I'm doing by sending you into exile is just making real what you've already decided. You've lost your identity a long time ago. So what we see is that God often takes away things in our lives that we use to kind of wrap our identity around. Things that we put in place of him. And this passage becomes a warning for us, God's people, that when that happens, when there are things that we say, this is what makes me who I am, God might just take that away from us. And it might be really, really painful. But he's doing it so that we would know who he is. He's doing it so that we might come back to him. God doesn't just destroy his people, see? When he does this, he references the potter. And what the potter did was he saw that the pot wasn't working out. So did he just smash that clay and throw it away? Get rid of it? No. He smashed that clay and then he started over with the same clay. He remade that clay into something new, into something beautiful. So what we see is when God treats us this way, he's not just destroying us, he's remaking us. He's making something new. God remakes us. The problem is that remaking something, rebuilding something, starts with destruction. It's like a developer who buys an old home on a nice lot. He tears down the home and destroys the house and cleans up the rubble and then builds something new. That's one of the ways that God works in our lives. He invites us to walk through something really difficult, something really painful. He destroys some of the things that we might think are essential to who we are because perhaps we've turned to them instead of him. But he does it for our sake. He does it so that he can remake us, so that he can rebuild us, because he has something better in mind. He has some new life he wants to invite us into. But it's painful. Rebuilding involves pain. And when you're on this side, you notice this passage only talks about the destruction. The implication is there that the potter remakes something new. Other passages in Jeremiah let us know what that new thing is. But when you're on this side of destruction, the rebuilding part seems kind of like a hazy mist. It can seem hard to remember that that's what's out there. when all you can see is your city being destroyed, your temple being leveled. There's some people here who might be in the midst of a really difficult season. Some people here, God might be working in their lives. Maybe he's taken away something from you, your health. Maybe some of you, your jobs, aspects of your family or relationships that are central to you. And maybe for you, it's hard to see that there's anything good beyond that, that God could possibly want to remake. It just seems like God is in the business of destroying. But there's others of us here who've been through seasons where you may have seen God work difficult things in your life. You may have walked through times of pain and destruction, and maybe you've come out the other side. And you've seen that God maybe had a purpose in that. You've seen the new life that he's built from that. And it's you who can encourage us to say, yes, this is true. I've seen God remake me in different ways. I've seen God remake his people. God is actually more than fair with us. He might ask us to go through hard things, but it's so that we would know him better. It's so that we might have the opportunity for some new life to rise up. And walking through those things leaves us back to this question, though, of who does God think he is? Who does he think he is that he would ask us to walk through these times? And the tragedy of this question is that often these types of experiences, even though they were meant to remake God's people, sometimes have caused people to walk away. There were Jews in Jerusalem who, when they saw the temple destroyed, they said, that's it, God has abandoned us. And because of that, they abandoned God, never to return. And that's a tragedy because God hadn't abandoned them. He was working in their lives. But people in our world, people in our lives, some of us have been tempted to say, it looks like God's abandoning us. Forget it. I'm going to leave him. This passage helps us to see that we are going to feel that way. That there will be times when, from our limited perspective, things don't seem fair. When I opened up with my trivia challenge, and I gave one person a $20 gift card, another person an expired coupon, most of you probably didn't immediately judge my character. Some of you did, but you probably know me better. but most of you probably didn't say, boy, Paul's a jerk for doing that. You probably said, Paul likes to do illustrations. I'll bet he's going to get at something with this, right? Well, what I'm suggesting is we give God kind of the same benefit. That when we get faced up with something that doesn't seem to make sense, when we encounter some area where it seems like, boy, God's not being fair. Why does this have to happen? That we trust his character and we trust that he's doing something. We know his plan. We know he's moving toward redemption. We know he has our interests in mind. And we know that it's not always going to seem that way from our perspective, but we can trust it. So that's the question we want to bring to God. And the beautiful thing about this, the beautiful thing about Jeremiah, is that he confronts God. So if you're going through something, it doesn't seem like it's fair, doesn't seem like this is right, tell God that. Say, God, what are you doing? Who do you think you are? Why are you treating me this way? Why are you treating somebody else this way? Ask him. Scream at him. Yell at him. Confront him. Challenge him. Just don't turn away from him. Just don't abandon him. Engage with him. See, this side of the life to come, we will probably never understand all the things that God is doing. We'll never know how he's working in our lives. But there'll come a time when we will, and we'll see all the pieces come together, and it's going to be beautiful. And I think we'll be amazed to see how much God loves us when we see that. Let me pray. God, thank you for this picture of Jeremiah and this picture of the potter and the clay, how he relates to his creation. And thanks for how it illustrates some of the ways that you relate to your creation, but also illustrates how much deeper and how much more personal and meaningful your relationship with us is. Thank you that that's true of you, and that even when it doesn't seem to be the case, that we know it's true. That you communicate in our language. You speak our language to us. You want us to understand you. That you're more than fair to us, and that when you invite us into hard things, you're not destroying us. You're remaking us, preparing us for some new life. I pray that we would be able to encourage each other with that truth, and that our hearts would be encouraged when we're in the middle of those seasons. Thanks, Father, and I pray that as we continue in worship, that you would be drawing us closer to you and helping us to connect with you. In the name of Jesus, amen.